afternoon, we call the Senate Resources Committee together at 3:31 p.m. on March 13th, 2023. Please silence all cell phones. Co-Chair Geisel, Mr. Dunbar, Senator Dunbar, Senator Klayman, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Kaufman, and Senator Kawasaki will be along, myself, Senator Bishop. Thank you, support staff, Carrie Cooperator, Amanda Kraft, and Senator Kawasaki, welcome. And Senator Wilson. Anything else I missed? Okay. Good. Welcome, everybody. Today, we have the first hearing of HJR 5, Alaska Fisheries, Troll Fisheries, sponsored by Representative Hemshute, and we're going to hear the second hearing of PFAS, SB 67, in its use in firefighting, sponsored by Senator Keel. In the continuation of our sexual analysis continuing from last Friday, we'll probably take a brief at ease there, and we'll change out the co-chairs, and Senator Geisel will then take over on the carbon storage. First up is HGR 5. This is the first hearing. Our intention is to hear this bill and look to the will of the committee. Representative Hemshute and Mr. Thatcher, please come on up and put yourselves on the record and start your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bishop. Rebecca Hemshute for the record. Appreciate your time today. This is my staff.
Dr. Brower, staff to Representative Hemshute.
So, Co-Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Geisel, members of the committee, thank you for having us here. HGR 5 urges federal and state agencies to continue to defend Alaska's fisheries, including the Southeast Alaska Troll Fishery, and I'd like to talk about why that's so important for just a second. In Southeast Alaska, and I think all of Alaska, this lawsuit filed by the Seattle-based Wild Fish Conservancy targeting the salmon troll fishery, which is a local fishery for Southeast Alaska, is a threat to our way of life. Our households rely on salmon for food. Our communities depend on salmon to support the fishing and tourism sectors that are pillars of our economy. We have every reason in the world to protect these fish. This lawsuit, we fear, is an attack currently on one that could become an attack on all. Rather than examining the pollution, vessel traffic, dams and salmon streams, and other pressures on the orcas in their area, the Wild Fish Conservancy has attacked the local troll fleet of Southeast Alaska, 1,000 miles to the north. I'd like to explain who the trollers are and what this lawsuit contends. So when we talk about trollers, it's really important to know that this is one of the most sustainable fisheries you could ever create. This is about 1,500 fishermen. They bring in about $85 million, once you magnify it out, into our local economy. And when I say they're sustainable, we have over 100 years of data showing that this fishery is sustainable. They catch each fish by hook and line. There might be some bycatch, but it's going to be the most limited bycatch in any fishery. It's a low barrier fishery. It's not that hard to get into this fishery, so as a result, you're going to be hard-pressed to find any community, no matter how small, including Myers Chuck, that wouldn't have a troller in it. So our families are trollers. Each trolling vessel is a family business. Each family business supports our schools, our economies, etc. When we talk about this lawsuit, we're talking about the Wild Fish Conservancy. It's a serial litigant, and we can go into the details. It's a pretty complicated issue, and Thatcher's been following the issue very closely. So if you'd like more information, we can turn it over to Thatcher. We also have invited testimony.
Thatcher, if you want to give us the highlights, please.
Great. Again, for the record, Thatcher Brower, staff to Representative Hemshute. Before I begin with a little background information, I guess I would like to say for the record, as a matter of full disclosure, that I am a commercial troller and fish in the summer and interim, and I'm also serve on the Alaska Troll Association Board of Directors. So with that, I guess I'd like to give a brief history of the lawsuit, and so to help explain why we are where we are today. Back in 2019, the National Marine Fisheries Service conducted a consultation and issued a biological opinion under the Endangered Species Act. And that considered the effect of implementing the fishing regimes in Southeast Alaska negotiated as part of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And it was looking to assess the impact of those fisheries on endangered species such as Chinook salmon and the southern resident killer whales. And as part of that process, an incidental take statement was issued, and that allows the Southeast fishery to be prosecuted. Then on March 18th of 2020, the Wild Fish Conservancy, a Washington-based organization, filed a complaint against the National Marine Fisheries Service. And they were seeking to invalidate the 2019 biological opinion. The Wild Fish Conservancy, as part of this complaint, sought to halt the production of Chinook salmon by Columbia River hatcheries that were intended to increase prey availability for the southern resident killer whales. They also sought to invalidate this incidental take statement, which is necessary for the Southeast fishery to proceed. Then in September of 2021, Magistrate Judge Michelle Peterson issued a report and recommendations finding that the analysis governing the Columbia River prey increase program was flawed, and that the incidental take statement governing the Southeast Estuarine troll fishery, was legally deficient. On August 8th of 2022, Judge Jones adopted Magistrate Peterson's report and recommendations. The National Marine Fisheries Service is in the process of rewriting the biological opinion, but that's expected to take some time. And then since the adoption of the magistrate report, the parties have engaged in a briefing on the remedy for the violations found by the National Marine Fisheries Service. And as part of that process, Judge Peterson issued a report and recommendations on December 13th, 2022, and that again invalidated the incidental take statement for Southeast Alaska troll fishery, putting both the winter and summer fisheries in jeopardy. And where we are today is that U.S. District Court Judge Jones is deliberating on the magistrate judge's report and recommendations, and his decision will likely be made any day now. If Judge Jones rules in the plaintiff's favor and the Wild Fish Conservancy's favor, then the case could be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, I'll take just a brief at ease. Now we're going to go to invited testimony. We're going to go to Amy Daugherty, Executive Director of Alaska Trollers, and I believe you're in the room.
Yeah.
Oh, you're the one that's buying donuts.
Yes, I'll make a point of that, Mr. Chairman.
No, I'm just teasing. I apologize. We don't enforce that. I don't enforce that rule here.
I'll bring them. Yes, Amy Daugherty. I am the director of Alaska Trollers Association. The troll fishery is older than the state, certainly, and older than written history or data collection by the Department of Fish and Game and its predecessor of the territory. Everything was kind of moving along as usual. We are subject to the treaty. As far as overall allocation and then the Board of Fish under that, until the spring of 2020 when we got hit broadside by this lawsuit. We have been doing a lot of outreach and a lot of fundraising ever since. I think Thatcher covered a lot of the detail. The reason we've really been ultra concerned and have really mobilized is because the last lower court, the Western Washington District Court, has actually two judges in it, and the lower one, the magistrate judge, gave us a very unfavorable R&R report and recommendation. So, yes, we are basically waiting for the senior judge to rule and doing every single thing that we can to keep our boats fishing and our economy throughout Southeast Alaska. And recently, there's been an amicus brief. I didn't know if that was covered. I don't think it was. Our entire of three congressional delegations filed an amicus brief to watch this matter based on the economic importance of the region which includes Yakutat as well. I can just answer questions.
Any questions from committee members before we go to our next presenter? Thank you for testifying. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Tim O'Connor, the Craig Mayor and Commercial Troller. He's on the phone. Mr. Mayor.
Hi, this is Tim O'Connor, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tim O'Connor. I'm the mayor of Craig, Alaska, also the vice president of Alaska Troller Association and a troller myself and a longliner. Craig has a population of just under 1,000 persons in the city limits and an additional 500 in the subdivisions outside the city limits adjacent to Craig. Prince of Wales has a population of about 4,000. Craig is the main port on Prince of Wales Island. It's ranked 30th in the nation for commercial seafood landings at 21 million pounds and 52nd in the nation in a value of $22.7 million. These rankings are based on the top 137 ports in the United States. Fishing is now the mainstay of Craig's economy since logging is all but gone on Prince of Wales Island and disappearing fast in Alaska. The commercial salmon troll industry is a significant portion of our fishing fleet. Our charter fleet on Prince of Wales is over 100 boats, with 20 fishing within the city limits of Craig. The charter industry is key to our economy for tax revenue as well as for other things. We stand to lose all of this if this Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit is successful. While the lawsuit is primarily concerned the troll industry at the moment, we're in risk of losing all the fishing gear groups as well. This could mean seines, trollers, and everyone. So the Alaska Troller Association and the City of Craig need the state's help and resources in stopping this lawsuit or challenging it. And our state's right to manage our fisheries is in jeopardy. The City of Craig recently passed Resolution 23-03 in support of ATA's lawsuit against or defense against the lawsuit brought by WSC. So please consider strongly this joint resolution committing resources to help the project and commercial fishing and the state's right to manage their own fisheries. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mayor. Next, we're gonna go to In the Room and Dana Evanson, Department of Fish and Game. Please come forward and put yourself on the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, my name is Danny Evanson, and I am an extended jurisdiction program manager at the Department of Fish and Game. Of my many hats, I serve as Alaska's Pacific Salmon Treaty Coordinator, and I have been the point person on this lawsuit for the state alongside Department of Law, Aaron Peterson, who could not be here today because he's at the Board of Fish meeting in Anchorage. So I'll try not to repeat too much of what has been said so far, but I thought I'd walk you a little bit more through the lawsuit, what it means, where we're at, and what the state viewpoint is, and I'll be available to answer any questions if you have any. So as Mr. Brower said, this case is a challenge to the National Marine Fisheries Service biological opinion for the Southeast Alaska salmon fishery. That's the document that gives us coverage to allow our fisheries to continue in the face of the Endangered Species Act. And it gives us coverage for incidental take should we incidentally harvest or injure an endangered species. Now, in Alaska, we're fortunate that we don't have any fish stocks listed under the ESA, the Endangered Species Act. At least I consider us fortunate. But we do have four stocks from the Pacific Northwest, from the Columbia River, from Puget Sound, and the Willamette River, which is also a tributary to the Columbia, that swim up in our waters, mostly in low numbers. By definition, an endangered species is rare, and rarer still in a distant mixed-up fishery. We also have both humpback whales, Mexican humpback whales, which are about 6% of all the humpbacks we see in Southeast Alaska that it provides coverage for, as well as Western Stellar Sea Lions, which are a small fraction of the sea lions, they're mostly eastern, that we see in Southeast Alaska, and then Southern Resident Killer Whales. Now, it's important to keep in mind, Southern Resident Killer Whales don't swim into our waters. There's only been one positive ID, and it was right at the boundary there, right at the entrance to Dixon, right at Dixon entrance. And since then, none have been observed. It is that we catch Chinook that might otherwise become prey. So I just wanted to make those points clear. And of course, the state of Alaska and the Alaska Trollers Association both intervene in this case. It's important to the economy. It's opportunity for Alaskans. As you know now, this case was brought forth by an ENGO, an environmental group based in Washington. And the lawsuit argues that the Southeast Alaska Chinook troll fishery threatens the survival of these several ESA-listed Chinook stocks in Washington and Oregon, and the survival of the southern resident killer whales that rely on them for food. And it specifically attacks Alaska's management of the troll fisheries that are managed under the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And as you heard from Mr. Brower, the federal court in the Western District of Washington ruled in favor of the Wild Fish Conservancy supporting their claims. And that was last August. The Wild Fish Conservancy disputed the provision of the biological opinion that required $118 million mitigation package. So in our biological opinion, we were required to go to Congress and get $118 million in mitigation measures to offset our impacts. And that included $31.2 million for Puget Sound habitat restoration, as if the Southeast Alaska fishery actually affected habitat in Puget Sound. It also required $3.06 million a year for Puget Sound conservation hatcheries, and no less than $5.6 million a year for killer whale prey production. And all that prey production, hatchery production, happens in the Pacific Northwest in places where it'll best benefit the killer whales. And so we're required to do this. And really, that's still the underpinning for every other fishery on the seaboard down south, because it's part of the environmental baseline that's considered when they do their biological opinions. So this is the foundation. So they attacked that. Specifically, they did not like the killer whale prey production program. Wild Fish Conservancy prefers wild fish. I think it's also important to note that this lawsuit didn't attack similar fisheries in Oregon and Washington that have even greater impacts on these fish that are fishing right in the location that the killer whales are. So the judge ruled on behalf of the plaintiff, Wild Fish Conservancy, citing that NIMS violated its obligations under the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act when they issued their incidental take statement. And that's the piece of paper we need that allows us to fish. So present situation, the lawsuit is currently in what's referred to as the remedy phase. U.S. Magistrate Judge Michelle Peterson issued her report and recommendation and a proposed order in December. And the magistrate recommends that the biological opinion be remanded to the National Marine Fisheries Service. And by remand, it means sent back to be rewritten to fix the flaws that they have with the Endangered Species Act and National Environmental Policy Act violations. And what we have heard from NIMS, they went on record saying that they expect to have the full meal deal done November 2024. In the meantime, they're looking for options for interim coverage. The second thing that she recommended was that portions of our biological opinion, portions of the incidental take statement, be vacated as they relate to Chinook, commercial Chinook troll fisheries in winter and summer. So while that biological opinion is being worked on, our fishery would not have ESA protections. So we are working, actively working. We've offered to help NIMS to rewrite that. They're looking at interim coverage, trying to get coverage. I've heard from my colleagues over there that they're hoping to have something in place by May. Whether that comes to fruition or not, I couldn't say. But they would do something interim and then look to have the full environmental impact statement done by November 2024. So at this point in time, the litigation is still active. All the briefings have been submitted. You heard our congressional delegation submitted an amicus brief in solidarity with all the defendants, which is a nice touch. Right now, our fisheries are proceeding as normal. We still have coverage until the judge rules. We have no idea when that will be. And we have offered our support to the National Marine Fisheries Service to help them rewrite that buyout, because we recognize time is of the essence here. And we also recognize there's a lot of anxiety out there not knowing what's going to happen. Certainly, this is going to have a lot of impacts. If we were to get an adverse ruling, the state will appeal it. We would file a stay. But, you know, again, it's hard to say whether that would come to fruition. From our perspective as the state of Alaska, we abide by the terms of the Pacific Salmon Treaty. All of our salmon fisheries in Southeast fall under that category, just about. Some of them are also managed under Magnus and Stevens. The ESA, we abide by all those, and it's troubling to us that they would selectively target our fisheries. We feel we have a responsibility to look out for our fisheries and the Southeast coastal communities and families that rely on them. We will defend the right for our fisheries to operate while NIMS addresses the flaws in their biological opinion. And that includes, as I said, that includes appealing any adverse decision that unjustly targets our fisheries. Further, Alaska is not going to tolerate the suspension of our fisheries while other West Coast fisheries, equally or more impactful to killer whales and dependent on the hatchery mitigation actions that are contained in our biological opinion, but not the target of the lawsuit, are allowed to continue. If this decision sticks, we'll be looking at having all other fisheries that affect these salmon being treated equally under the law. And I guess I'll leave it there and see if there's any questions.
I don't see any questions. You did a great job on your overview, though. I learned a lot. Senator Klayman has a question, though.
In the litigation, it's a little unclear to me what the judge has ruled in favor of the plaintiffs on and what remedy they're looking at, because it sounds like there's an evaluation that was rejected as incomplete and they're supposed to go back and do it again or in at least certain parts of it. But I'm a little unclear about where that puts the actual process in court.
Thank you for the question, through the chair to Senator Klayman. I think if I understood your question, you're asking what the ruling was and where we're at and how these pieces fit together. And I had that in my statement, but I decided not to get us too far into the weeds.
We've got three lawyers here, so don't just relax.
Oh, I'm in trouble. That I am not. But I'm fast learning. So the key points from the judge's order on summary judgment included, one, that NIMS actions require certain mitigation. So one of the things they flagged was because we had this $118 million mitigation package, and some of those were annual. So for the hatchery production, we were required to provide no less than $5.6 million a year for two NIMS to produce hatchery fish. Congressional appropriations are annual, so you can't guarantee those, and that's what this judge was saying. And that was something I know that the U.S. Department of Justice was very interested in, and getting overturned, I guess if that's the right way to say that. NIMS also failed to create binding mitigation measures that described in detail the action agency's plan to offset the environmental damage caused by the project for the prey increase program. And what is meant there is that if you're going to increase hatchery fish and you have ESA, Endangered Species Act, listed species nearby, does that have an impact? And they are addressing it. They're addressing it in separate biological opinions for each hatchery. Then the National Marine Fisheries Service's failure to make a jeopardy determination on the prey increase program for the Chinook salmon, the listed Chinook salmon violated its obligations under the Endangered Species Act, and that NIMS violated the National Environmental Policy Act requirements in issuing its incidental take statement. So that was the first part, but then you get to remedy. Is that too detailed?
I can take this up offline.
Offline? Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm taking it.
Senator Kawasaki has a question.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief one. I know we're only asking about the Southeast Alaska troll fishery and holding them harmless. Are there other fisheries that are currently potentially impacted by the ruling, and what are they, and to what extent?
Thank you for that question through the chair to Senator Kawasaki. The answer is no. This ruling at this point is just targeting troll Chinook fisheries in Southeast Alaska, and right now it's just the troll fishery that happens in the winter and in the summer months, and not in the spring at this point in time.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say a statement and a question off of Senator Kawasaki's question. I had the opportunity, like most people that grow up in Cordova and similar towns, to work on a seiner. And if the troll fishery can be a target, then there is no question in my mind that other gear types will be a target in the near future. And so I think it behooves us to stand with the trollers. My question is, how did they even justify only coming after the Alaska fishery when Washington and Oregon fisheries were left out? I mean, I understand that. I hope you pursue actions to make them also have the same consequences if these are imposed on us, but how did the NGO even justify it?
Through the chair, thank you for that question, Senator Dunbar. Some of this will be speculative, but the Wild Fish Conservancy targeted our troll fishery, because in our biological opinion was the one that had the $118 million mitigation package. So we have $56 million going to prey production, and it's our fishery that's tied to it. Now, why they specifically went after troll, I can only speculate that that's where the lion's share of the harvest is. One might also speculate that they have a board membership made up of sport fishermen. So it could be any of those things, but reading between the lines, I would say in their mind, if you don't have a troll fishery in Alaska, then you don't need all this hatchery production coming out of the lower 48 to support it, that one would offset the other. But in reality, all of our fisheries on the seaboard rely on this mitigation measure. And foregone harvest in Southeast Alaska does not equal a commensurate level of fish available to killer whales. We have stocks from Southeast Alaska and Northern British Columbia in our catch. Those don't go south. We have a gauntlet of fisheries and a gauntlet of predators that these fish must swim through on their way back.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I apologize for Danny for mispronouncing your name, but I got it now.
Thank
okay,
you.
Now we're done with our invited testimony, and we're on to the next segment of our public testimony. Is anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none and seeing none online, this appears that this will conclude our public testimony. Senator Giesel?
Mr. Chairman, I am pleased to move the HJR 5 Work Order 33LS0338/U uniform out of this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objection, this bill is moved from committee. We'll take a brief please while we sign the committee document. Brief please. We're back on the record. Next up is the second hearing of Senate Bill 67. Today we'll begin hearing public testimony on PFAS use in firefighting. So we're going to go right into public testimony. And we're going to go online first to Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council in Valdez. Joe Laley, is that right?
Yes.
Yes, and please put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Thank you to the chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Lally, and I am testifying today on behalf of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. I have worked for the council for 5 years and currently serve as the council's director of programs. The council is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to promote environmentally safe operation of the Valdez Marine Terminal and associated tankers. We are mandated by Congress and represent communities from Valdez down to Kodiak Island, as well as commercial fishing, aquaculture, native, recreation, tourism, and environmental interests. Because of the relatively narrow focus of the Council's mission, our interest in SB 67 is limited to aqueous film-forming foam that is stored at the Valdez Marine Terminal and on some of the related vessels for the purpose of suppressing fires. As members of the committee are aware, AFFF contain perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, that are known for their persistence in the environment and harmful effects to people and animals. Any release of AFFF could result in the contamination of drinking water and state waters, including Prince William Sound. With this in mind, the Council submitted a letter of support for consideration during today's hearing. The Council supports proposed language on pages 1 and 2 of SB 67, version 33LS0148B, authorizing the Alaska State Fire Marshal to restrict the use of firefighting substances that contain PFAS in the state when he or she determines an alternative non-PFAS substance is available. Such a determination would be based on alternative firefighting substance being approved by the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration. While the Council is mindful of pollution impacts that could result from a catastrophic fire, we are also concerned about environmental harm that could result from suppression using PFAS-containing substances, as well as the release of PFAS during testing of equipment or accidentally. Therefore, the Council supports the State Fire Marshal in making a determination regarding whether satisfactory firefighting results can be achieved now or in the future using more environmentally safe substances and to restrict the use of PFAS. A secondary matter of concern that could be mitigated as part of passage of SB 67 stems from past appropriations that have been made from Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention and Response Fund, or Response Fund, for the purpose of responding to releases of PFAS statewide. It is proper for the state to respond and deal with such hazardous substance releases. However, while the statutes do allow the Department of Environmental Conservation to use the response fund to assess the releases of PFAS that pose an imminent and substantial threat to public health and welfare or to the environment, it was never intended to pay all the long-term cost of remediation after the initial emergency had passed. A danger of using the response fund for long-term PFAS remediation that every dollar spent on such activity reduces the amount available for swift response to an oil spill or hazardous substance release disaster. The overarching purpose of the fund is to allow for speedy and full response to an acute disaster such as an oil spill. However, using the fund for long-term PFAS remediation could easily drain the fund to zero and could result in the state being less able to respond immediately to an oil spill or chemical release. The Council fully supports the passage of this legislation and will advance protection of state waters, including Prince William Sound, from PFAS contamination.
Please send in the rest of your comments to the committee, please. Thank you. Next up, and the testimony is 2 minutes. We've got a tight schedule here, another bill. So, Michelle Meyer, Alaska Community Action on Toxins, I believe you're in the room, and please come forward and put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please. And if you have any testimony that's over 2 minutes, would you leave it with us? Thank you.
Well, thank you to the committee. My name is Michelle Meyer. Gunas Cheesh for the opportunity to speak in support of SB 67 regarding firefighting foam. I'm here today with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics and as a former long-term resident of Yakutat and Anchorage and a cancer survivor. I grew up in Yakutat, a community just north of Juneau with a rich Tlingit history and culture, and I'm a member of the Yakutat Tlingit tribe. As you likely know, Yakutat was a large military base during World War II and has residual PCB and dioxin that remains of concern today. Yakutat's water is contaminated by PFAS from the use of firefighting foam at the airport, and Yakutat is in a cancer crisis. We know the PFAS spectrum causes cancer, including testicular cancer, bladder, kidney, and childhood cancers like acute lymphoblastic leukemia. In 2019, at the age of 56, I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia, which is rare. It's very rare in adults. Just around 6,500 adults are diagnosed in the U.S. each year with it, and the overall survival is around 25%. Rare was the word used too frequently by my doctors to describe my case as I fought for the next 2 years to survive. I'm just 2 years in remission now, and I believe my cancer was caused by PFAS exposure. For 5 years, from kindergarten through the fifth grade, I drank from well water at my school near the Yakutat Airport, and it was also on the plume of contamination. Rare. Well, PFAS is not rare. It's everywhere, and it shouldn't be in Alaska's drinking water. PFAS shouldn't continue to be used by people in our firefighting organizations. My father, brother, and husband served as volunteer firefighters in Yakutat. Now my youngest son serves his community as a volunteer fireman in Yakutat. I worry about everyone who has to put on turnout gear contaminated by PFAS and has to use foam that contains PFAS when some 30 options are available for non-toxic biodegradable alternatives. Thank you for your support of SB 67. Gunas Cheesh.
Thank you for your testimony, and we're glad to hear that you're in remission. Thank you. Next up, Adam Ortega, Alaska Community Action on Toxins. Please come forward. Put yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please. Adam Ortega. Welcome. Yourself on the record in 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Appreciate it. I'm Adam Ortega. I'm a representative from Alaska Community Action on Toxics. We're working to pass Senate Bill 67, which would phase out PFAS from firefighting foams. And the biggest source of contamination from PFAS in Alaska comes from different military bases and airports, which have contaminated the drinking water for thousands of Alaskans. So we feel that SB 67 needs to pass now to phase out PFAS from some of these forever chemicals that we know do not break down in the environment. So thank you for letting me speak, and I hope my colleagues persuade you to pass this very important Senate bill. So
thank you, sir, for your testimony. Next up, we'll have...
Thank you very much.
Therese Lee, Alaska Community Action on Toxins, and I know she's here because I saw her.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Patrice Lee, and I live in Fairbanks. Fairbanks, our Golden Heart Utilities, has four kinds of PFAS in our municipal water source. The total amount is, when you add them together, exceeds the 70 parts per trillion allowed, which is grossly overstated as it is. It is not protective of health. Scores of lakes can no longer be fished in. The fish cannot be taken or eaten. And my very favorite family place, the Pile Driver Slough, where we've always spent Mother's Day, can no longer be fished in because it's contaminated with PFAS. 55,000 gallons of PFAS substances were dumped into the Rolling Stone gravel pit. ADEC is very aware of it. It's all documented. The PFAS is moving with the plume towards Salcha River and towards Harding Lake. Many of you know that's Salcha River is one of the most beautiful fisheries anywhere, and many prominent citizens or people have summer homes at Harding Lake. I have a question. If the state of Alaska doesn't even pass a law to ban the further use of PFAS, well, we have a lawsuit. It says here under the Juneau Empire State sues DuPont and other PFAS manufacturers. If we haven't even passed any action to say that we don't want to use it anymore, how are we going to prevail in the lawsuit? When it gets to court, they're not going to think we're very serious if we're still using it. It might make us sound kind of disingenuous, maybe. I would like to suggest that this bill doesn't go far enough. It's a start, but we've had much more comprehensive bills. I would like to see us expand Senate Bill 67 to at least include the legislature to insist on or require that Alaska set a safe drinking water standard. Many states are doing this without waiting for the EPA. We don't need to wait for the EPA. We can set our own standard and be proactive. So thank you very much. Thank
you, Patrice. Next up, we got Pam Miller, Alaska Community Action on Toxins, and that's our last presenter. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Resource Committee.
Co-Chair Senator Bishop and Giesel and members of the committee, thank you for taking testimony today on Senate Bill 67, a bill to prevent further PFAS contamination. And we do believe that this is a very important first step to turn off the tap of pollution that is contaminating the drinking water of people from the North Slope of Alaska through Southeast. And this is a very serious public health issue. As you've heard in testimony, PFAS are a very complex group of chemicals known as forever chemicals, 12,000 in the group, many of them found in firefighting foams that have been used dispersively. There are safe alternatives to the use of PFAS in firefighting foam. Many of them have been certified through a third-party certification program called the Green Screen. They're safe, they're effective, they're proven. There's no reason to delay any action on this respect because there are safe alternatives. In 2019, we did an investigative report that found about 100 sites around Alaska contaminated with PFAS. Now the current DEC database says that there are now 469 sites around Alaska that have PFAS contamination in soil and or water. Again, this is a very serious public health issue. There are really no safe levels of exposure to these toxic chemicals. Much as with lead, the latest science as it's evolving is showing that these chemicals can cause health effects at below one part per trillion level. The state's current standard is 70 parts per trillion. So if you have a drinking water well with 65 parts per trillion, you would be provided with a safe drinking water source. If you are below 10 parts per trillion, you would not be given a safe drinking water source. So again, we need to take measures urgently to protect the safe drinking water of all Alaskans. And other states, as Patrice indicated, are taking the lead in this respect in enacting comprehensive legislation, not just addressing PFAS and firefighting foam, but establishing health-protective drinking water standards, in taking action to phase out all uses or non-essential uses of PFAS in many products that they're also found in, such as textiles, other household products. So we really urge you to pass Senate Bill 67, but take additional measures to protect the health of Alaskans, including the safe drinking water standards that are enforceable, phasing out PFAS and firefighting foams and other product categories, providing safe alternative drinking water sources to those communities that are affected. We also would call for medical monitoring of people that are potentially or are affected by PFAS contamination.
Could you wrap up and read us, and read us your testimony?
Yes, I will. Sure. Yes, thank you. So I guess I would just close by saying please pass Senate Bill 67 out of committee today and take urgent steps and look at more comprehensive ways to regulate this very problematic class of chemicals.
Thank you for
again, thank you. And I'll leave testimony and some other materials.
Next, we got one more online, Tim Shestick, American Chemistry Council, Sacramento, California. And if you can hear us, Tim, 2 minutes. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Diesel. For the record, Tim Shestick with the American Chemistry Council. Thank you for the opportunity to offer some brief comments today regarding Senate Bill 67. My organization has supported state legislation around the country to restrict the use of PFAS-containing firefighting foam for training and testing purposes. And while some states have imposed broad restrictions on the use of PFAS-containing firefighting foam, many have also included waivers and or exemptions for industries that may need to access these types of foams to combat flammable liquid fires. But some of those facilities could include chemical manufacturers, storage distribution facilities, and tank farms that may have large quantities of flammable liquids on site. SB 67 does recognize the oil and gas industry under Section 1B, and should you decide to move this bill forward, we would just encourage you to consider and assess whether there are other facilities in the state that may need access to these types of foams in the event of a real-world emergency. We'd welcome the opportunity to work with the committee and the legislature on this certainly a very important issue. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony and being succinct. We're going to close public testimony, and we're going to set this bill aside as we are anticipating an updated fiscal note that we haven't received yet, and we're going to take a brief at ease and switch out chairs.
I call Senate Resources back to order. We are now moving to Senate Bill 49, which is carbon sequestration. We're continuing a sectional analysis presentation by the Department of Natural Resources. We are in slide 22, and we're on the last item of that slide, which is a review of section 14 of Senate Bill 49. So, at the table, we have Deputy Commissioner John Crowther and Deputy Director Haley Payne. Ms. Payne, I believe you were the speaker?
I think I'm the lucky one, yes. Thank you. Good afternoon. All right. For the record, my name is Haley Payne. I am the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. As indicated, we're hoping to continue on with our sectional analysis and summary. We are on slide 22. Which is merely just a note of continuation that we'll be spending the next couple slides going into more detail on what exactly Section 14 does, which really impacts the predominant aspects for DNR and the licensing of the state's pore space. So moving on to slide 23, this is an image that was brought up before the committee previously, essentially just bringing us back to that timeline continuum of how long it takes to develop a project. The difference being now we've started to overlay the different components of the bill along this as well. As you'll see at the top, we are noting at what point a carbon storage exploration license would come to play, and then ultimately when a carbon storage lease would come to play. And so section 14, where the yellow arrow is drawn, is really going to sort of draw your attention to the fact that it's after that screening and once we get to feasibility that these this section will really apply.
Seeing no questions, you may move on.
Great. So all of these components are a part of section 14 here. So 3805-700 is really just going to start off with a policy statement that it is the public interest to promote geologic storage of carbon dioxide. Moving into 705, we are vesting the authority for DNR in order to adopt regulations and implement the statutes that are about to follow. In section 710, AS 3805-710, this is where we start to detail what the carbon storage exploration license does. And so here we're laying out the basics, the five-year exploration license term, the minimum economic terms that are included with that, bonding requirements, and how the renewal provisions for an exploration license would need to be performed. It also lays out that you can convert this exploration license to a carbon storage lease once you complete your work commitment and all of the other requirements of the license.
Any questions on that section? Seeing none.
Great. In 715, it just talks about the procedures for obtaining one of these carbon storage exploration licenses. Again, this is going to be similar to our oil and gas exploration license project where a nomination occurs, someone submits an application detailing an area of land that they would like to pursue. The department would then put that out to public notice and also call for competing proposals on that as well. Once that process is complete, we would go through a best interest finding in order to determine whether or not that license is in the best interest of the state, and outline any particular terms or different requirements that would be necessary for that. There is one portion of this for carbon storage exploration licensing, which is different from oil and gas exploration, and that's found in provision H. And so that particular provision grants a right of first refusal opportunity in the competitive process for those who have existing leases in the mineral section of the state. So essentially recognizing the infrastructure, the knowledge and the experience that an operator may already possess, and to also help to deconflict over anything in case there was interest from the existing oil and gas lessee, as well as another third party.
Any questions on that section? Nobody's worried about competitive bids or any, the commissioner concluding who gets the bid? Senator Bishop, just asking.
No, I
did a long pause.
I just got to go back to 710 for a second. Mm-hmm. Conversion of the license to a lease upon fulfillment of work commitment, et cetera, et cetera. So if you make the conversion, how long is that lease good for?
Chair Bishop, so this conversion would be based on, once you have that lease is good for as long as that carbon storage facility is in operation. So that's going to cover the entire duration of construction, operation, and then those post-closure activities that will take place. So just as in an oil and gas lease, you have a primary term where you're allowed to do your exploration work. In order to hold it past that primary term, you have to be engaged in actual production. And so this is similarly built on that model. It's meant to cover, there's not a specific year, it's just as operations continue.
Thank you.
Other questions? How about if I ask on 710 subsection H, it says dollar amounts shall change every 5 years.
Yes, Chair Giesel, thank you for that. So we did include some minimum statutory values for a per acre as well as a per ton injection charge, but we do recognize that those minimums can get dated fairly quickly, and so this is just an opportunity to reevaluate and increase those along with the consumer price index.
Very good. Any other questions? Yes, Senator Klayman.
Just following up on that, it seems like we tried to have some consumer price indexing for other parts of statute, and it seems like it's always complicated, and this seems remarkably simple. Is that really going to work, or will we have to take action to increase the price that's listed?
Senator Clayman, through the chair, I do believe that functionally, and hopefully it would be as simple as articulated here, but I don't have as much experience with some of those other provisions. Perhaps Deputy Commissioner Crowther can add to that.
Senator Clayman, through the chair, for the record, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. I think these provisions in the statute provide a floor, and so we're recognizing that that floor would bump up over time, but it's very conceivable the department, through regulation or just the process of negotiating these leases, would include higher than the floor at any time, and that that might become essentially a standard above and beyond the statute. And that's somewhat analogous to some other floor provisions we have in our oil and gas leasing statute. So.
Any other questions on, let's see, it was 715 or 715? Pardon me, 715H. Yes, was our last one. Seeing none, I'll let you continue.
Thank you. So moving forward to 3805720, this really just is the provision that outlines that conversion process from an exploration license to a lease, just reiterating the terms under which that would be done. In 725, we have another mechanism where if there is a reservoir that is currently being used for enhanced oil recovery through CO2, and that operator would like to convert that to no longer being used for enhanced oil recovery to strictly for carbon storage, we're simply spelling out that there is a requirement to thus obtain a carbon storage lease because enhanced oil recovery is no longer being contemplated and it's now transitioning to sequestration.
I see no questions.
Looking at 730, again, this is just asking for requirements for plans of development and operations. This is how the division is able to keep track and do annual updates with all of our operators for oil and gas. And similarly, we would want those same requirements for the carbon storage leasing and licensing. 735, we have the allocation of payments and how they are directed according to the Constitution, consistent with other mineral interest rights. And then finally, this section wraps up with definitions for the specific terms that were used here.
Any questions on Section 14? Senator Bishop.
I'd like to go back to 735. Payments from the carbon storage licenses and leases are deposited to the general fund, except for the amount allocated to the permanent fund. So what percentage is going to go to the permanent fund?
Chair Bishop, I do believe that at this point in time, there's provisions that allocate for mineral interest 25% to go to the permanent fund, and then there's a newer generation of leases that have started with the 50%. So I would have to defer to Department of Law under which one this would necessarily fall into.
I don't see anyone from Department of Law necessarily online.
We can follow up, Madam Chair, later.
We can get that question answered. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Yeah. Other questions on Section 14? All right, seeing none.
So then moving forward to Sections 15 through 31 here. So again, in Sections 15 through 15 through 20 is really where we start to incorporate carbon dioxide into our Right-of-Way Leasing Act. So this would enable the state pipeline coordinator to authorize the development and use of pipelines for carbon transportation. So essentially, it's just adding carbon dioxide to those definitions of the products of transportation facilities. It does also allow the DNR commissioner to exempt those pipelines from right-of-way leasing when in-field lines such as easements are more appropriate. And just to clarify, that exemption does not take them from being regulated. It just has them regulated. They would still be looked over by the pipeline coordinator, just not under a right-of-way lease, but under a different authorization called an easement.
So, Deputy Director, it sounds like you're putting this in just as a potential. You discussed earlier that a pipeline would be unlikely, that the storage would likely take place where the carbon was being produced. Is that most accurate?
Co-Chair Giesel, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. So these sections of the bill bring carbon dioxide pipelines in total conformance with our existing oil and gas pipeline regulatory system, which contemplates the potential for long distance, you know, large scale transportation style pipelines, but also the inherent need of pipelines either with across short distances, but across units, or with even within a unit, very short distances. And so this gives us the authority to manage all those different scenarios. We anticipate for carbon dioxide pipelines, they would likely be, especially at the beginning of projects, very short. And so the idea of a dozens or 100-mile long line, very unlikely. But this authority, were that to be proposed, we'd have the authority to evaluate it and regulate it.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Yes, Senator Bishop.
John, Director Brothers, 38-3502-OA, that's for a complete standalone new pipeline, not repurposing an existing abandoned oil pipeline. Is that correct?
Chair Bishop, this is, again, for the record, is Haley Payne. So, yes, this is so if you were going to obtain a brand new right-of-way lease to, for construction of a pipeline, that you would be able to obtain that lease through this provision here. So this is not for a repurposing provision. This is for a new right-of-way.
This one make clear in a follow-up. And that's with it. That could be within an, say we were with an existing right-of-way with an active loaded petroleum pipeline. Would can you tell me how that would work?
Yes, Chair Bishop. So our right-of-way leasing is for non-exclusive access, and so you'll see oftentimes where pipelines are able to share VSMs, and so there may be an existing pipeline right-of-way there, but you could imagine repurposing that infrastructure and being able to build, subject to safety and engineering aspects, of course, another pipeline alongside of that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, I'll let you proceed.
Oh, sorry, I got ahead of myself there. So we're still here on slide 25. So after this portion, we're going to look to sections 22 through 30. And these are just conforming amendments. So we're going to be adding carbon dioxide to the same chapter, essentially, that geothermal is found in. And so all of the notations here, we're not doing anything to geothermal. We're just adding another article within that.
Any questions about those sections? Senator Wilikowski.
Maybe I missed the opportunity on section 16. Looks like you're exempting from regulation construction or operation of a pipeline transporting carbon dioxide within a field for purpose of enhanced oil recovery project or field pressurization measures. Why would you do that?
So Senator Wilikowski through the chair, John Crowther here. Section 16 here, AS 38-3502-OB, that exempts those pipelines from right-of-way leasing, so the requirement to acquire a specific lease for the pipeline itself. It doesn't necessarily exempt that pipeline from the regulation in the course of those operations are within an existing right-of-way or activity or development site.
And just to supplement, again, this is Haley Payne. We do currently exempt infield gathering lines. So within a unit in the oil and gas context, they are not required to have a right-of-way lease. They are covered under a different authorization.
Any follow-up? Yes, Senator Wilikowski.
Is this limited to within a unit or a field?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we'd have to get back to you about the exact jurisdictional situation, hypothetical situations that could occur. In the vast entirety and practice of those kinds of authorizations, they've been within the context of an existing development or existing authorization, you know, lines that are necessary to effectuate operations. But if we could get back to you with how the exact contours of that jurisdiction.
Yeah, thank you. And if I could clarify, I'm sure. Yeah, I've just the what I'm curious about is, could this affect someone's private property rights?
Yes, Senator Wilikowski through the chair. You know, these authorities are for purposes of leasing out state lands to site infrastructure on the surface associated with a project. And so it's really a drawing lines, you know, when there's a need to obtain that right to use state surface land for a pipeline, does it require an independent right-of-way authorization, or is it coextensive with some existing state service authorization? This does not grant operators the authority to site things on private land, although there are, in some cases, processes for an operator to seek authorizations. You know, obviously, private landowners can voluntarily grant authorizations. There are potential authorities for surface infrastructure across private lands, but those recognize that private right and the rights are a process for adjudicating it.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none.
Thank you. So I'm still on slide 25 here, just the last bullet. We're going to be moving forward into section 31, which is indicated before as the other substantive sort of section, and this one will be impacting AOGCC. So if you'll turn to slide 26, again, we have that same image, and now you can see where the AOGCC carbon storage permit would fit into this, and section 31 details that authority and goes into the specifics of this.
Any questions on AOGCC and what the section contains? It's pretty long.
I'll move forward to slide 27, which will begin all of those many details of that section 31. So to start off with, we again just have a general policy statement that incorporates the need for AOGCC to regulate this in a manner that is protective of waters and reservoir integrity, and also recognizes the need for a cooperative interest. In section 110, this provides AOGCC the jurisdiction over carbon dioxide storage facilities, prevent waste, protect correlative rights, and ensure public health and safety. 4106.115 is really where we get into that whole authority for AOGCC to carry out the purposes of this. It essentially enables them to be able to regulate it from everything to construction, to operation, and through the closure. Always continuing on with those mandates to protect waters, to protect public health, and to protect the subsurface, ensuring that the CO2 that is injected is of a quality in order to be able to maintain that as well. And then lastly, we have 4106.120 that just provides that waste is prohibited in a carbon storage facility or reservoir.
No questions. Pardon me, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I found it in another section. My question's been answered. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very good. I'll let you proceed, Deputy Director.
Thank you. So on slide 28, here we are still continuing with section 31. AS 4106.125 provides the permit requirements for storage facilities. It's quite a lengthy list there. I think there are 14 different ones. If the committee has any questions, I'm happy to walk through those. 130 takes us to creating a public hearing requirement for storage facilities issued by AOGCC. It gives the requirements for everyone that notice will have to go to. So this includes both surface owners, mineral interest owners, mineral lessees within the boundaries of the area and also within a half a mile. That they must receive direct notification.
No questions.
Okay. 135 specifies the criteria for which the AOGCC will review for the approval of a carbon storage facility permit. And in 140, this allows AOGCC to include other parameters, limitations, or restrictions, and to protect the correlative rights of other persons.
No questions. Oh, Senator Bishop.
AS 4106145, concerns of amalgamation of property interests for storage facilities. Can you go a little deeper on that for me, please?
Sure thing. Chair Bishop, again, this is Haley Payne. So essentially what that allows is that all storage facility operators are required to obtain the consent of those different owners in the areas. Should there be a non-consenting owner, the AOGCC has the authority to amalgamate those property interests on the subsurface and still allow the use of that storage container so long as there is proper compensation given to that non-consenting owner. This again is in line with how we work for oil and gas and has very similar language as was done for oil and gas licensing.
Thank you.
No other questions. Go ahead.
Okay. So 4106150 creates specifications for needing to record this certificate so that other property interest owners or people in the future will be able to see it on the title. 160 clarifies the preservations of rights, includes the deconfliction of development of other minerals, and essentially states that the use of an area for carbon storage facility will not block that up for other future uses and continues to impress those existing as well as those future mineral interest rights.
No questions.
Okay, and then 165 provides the authority for AOGCC to collect fees, and it establishes the Carbon Dioxide Storage Facility Administration Fund, and we did go over this in the previous hearing as well. 170 specifies that storage operators will hold title to the injection CO2 and until a certificate of closure is issued under 175, and that includes any liability for damage associated with the injected CO2. And then lastly, in 175, that begins to transition us into the certificate of completion. It specifies the 8 different criteria that would have to be met before the AOGCC would issue such an order. And at that time, the transfer of title of the CO2 would go to the state.
No questions. Pardon me, Senator Dundemer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think I understand the value of the CO2, in this form after it's transferred to the state. But can you speak a little bit more about how the state is protected, from ongoing costs, or I understand there are these eight requirements before it's certified. But let's say that the company, does this and is able to get certified, but we then discover some evidence in the future that it was wrongly certified. How we could, go back to that company to try to preserve or protect ourselves from liability, and also what happens, in that case if the entity has gone bankrupt or is no longer in existence for some other reason.
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. So to answer the first part of your question, along with this sort of closure certificate, there is over the life of the project going to be that carbon storage trust fund. And so that is the mechanism through which the time for which the project is in operation, through which the state would receive funds. It is the funds that are in that account and only those funds that are in that account that are available to be able to take on these different actions and activities. Some of the details of this do also clarify that, acts of negligence or, willful or lawful sort of misrepresentations kind of nullify some of that protection. But essentially, we would still have the same mechanisms that we do today where you go back to a company and hold them liable and responsible. If in your scenario that company is no longer in existence and is sort of long gone, is hopefully what the Carbon Storage Trust Fund is meant to be able to protect against. But certainly, that's the limit to which we can provide for at this time in the statute.
Okay.
Follow up?
Yeah, just a brief comment to follow up. I think what's unique about this, right, we have the same challenges with major mines, for example. But what's different about this is we are sort of being given title to this. I don't know if you describe it as an asset. I think it is an asset when it's stored in that form. But it's also a liability because we have to prevent it from leaking, right? And so just think I need to think a little bit more about that transfer of title and what that really means for us going. Thank you for your answer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Seeing none.
Okay, so I'll be moving forward then to slide 29. Here we get into other authorities for being able to collect the carbon storage facility injection surcharge, as was just discussed with Senator Dunbar. Section 185 provides for AOGCC to be able to impose civil penalties for violation of its carbon storage statutes, again, consistent with oil and gas. 190 excludes AOGCC's carbon storage statutes from enhanced oil recovery. Enhanced oil recovery is already contemplated under our existing statutes and is a part of our existing lease agreements as well. 195 is the authority for AOGCC to enter in agreements with other government entities and agencies for carbon storage purposes. Any cooperative work that would need to take place between DEC and DNR is an example of this. 200 is the authority for AOGCC to determine amounts for injection and storage. And this provides for fees so that AOGCC would be able to charge for the service, which is going to be very valuable for those who are trying to collect on their 45Q tax credits. And then finally, 210 is just the definition system section for AOGCC.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. The definition of carbon dioxide on section 210 looks unusual.
You have to forgive me as I scroll.
Usually in a definition, you don't use the same word in defining it. And I'm just curious why you chose to define it in that way.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, John Crowther here. As I think you'll see in the definition, you know, the term carbon dioxide is used throughout the statute to refer to functionally the quality and composition of carbon dioxide necessary for these projects to be safely administered. So in that division, or in that definition, we're trying to indicate that it's being used as a technical term throughout the statute, in the sense that if you have in a lay definition carbon dioxide that contains impurities or is, you know, contains water or other, I guess you could say, contaminants or substances, that could compromise the safety of the storage itself or the operations associated with the injection. So that's the rationale for that definition, but we're certainly welcome insights about, you know, conforming to the standard process for defining terms in legislation.
Follow up.
Is that a standard definition in the industry?
I think, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, it's considered standard that there does need to be a recognition that carbon dioxide has to be of a suitable quality and purity to be safely managed in these facilities. And so I think that I don't know off the top of my head how other states have enforced that, but we have modeled our program after that. So we can get back to the committee of how other states have defined that the compound itself.
Senator Wilkowski.
I think that'd be worthwhile. I don't know if it's a big deal or not, but it seems that if we're dealing with a bill on carbon dioxide, the definition of carbon dioxide is probably pretty important. And this definition seems very unusual to me. And I would be curious what other states do, because it doesn't deal with purity. It says will not, carbon dioxide means carbon dioxide of a quality that will not compromise the safety of geologic storage and will not compromise the properties of a storage reservoir. It just seems like a very unusual definition.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we'll get back to the committee and with how other states do it and our thoughts about conforming the intent there.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be a higher level question, but you know, it occurs to me now that, you know, this we're talking specifically about carbon dioxide. But carbon dioxide is not the only greenhouse gas. In fact, there are some that are much more damaging, sort of on a, you know, per unit basis. Could this law, as it's written, be used to inject any other kind of gas? And is there a functioning market for any other kind of gas storage? Or, you know, if we discover that we can also store some other kind of gas safely, will we have to amend this or come back to change this?
Yes, Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I think that this legislation specifically in the Alaska context and this topic generally in the national and international context is focused on carbon dioxide, both from a kind of technical, you know, the properties of carbon dioxide, its role in, as an emissions byproduct, et cetera. You know, there are active programs, for instance, natural gas, methane, valuable as an energy commodity. There's efforts to store it, to efficiently manage when and how it's used. That occurs in Alaska in Tsingsa and the Cook Inlet. You know, and there's certainly efforts to manage other gas byproducts of industrial activities or otherwise. But I don't think geologic sequestration is an active focus for most of those other things, but this legislation is purely focused on carbon dioxide, not other greenhouse gases.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Klayman.
I want to follow up on some of the other questions. In a, the structure is there's this five-year lease, and somebody gets the lease, and then if they get the lease and then they inject some carbon dioxide into the lease, then they essentially keep the lease indefinitely. And in that sense, it's kind of the reverse of a typical oil or gas lease, in which they're basically have the lease until they get the product down to the ground, and then you basically close up the well when they've gotten all they can get out economically, then they close up the well and go home. But here we're actually asking people to take a lease, and then if they succeed, and then they're kind of indefinitely signed up to manage that. What's in this structure that deals with the lessee that decides, well, they did their 10 years of work, they want to go home now? How do we deal with that?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, you've pointed out wisely that this is sort of like an inverse operation. So in this scenario, we can imagine that it's possible through the modeling efforts and everything initially to determine what that size of the actual container is. So while we don't have like a date certain, we are able to say through the modeling that this reservoir could take X amount of CO2 over the period of like 25 years. And so there wouldn't be an end date on the contract of the lease, but we do have an actual, I guess, finite term in a manner of speaking. Now, to your point about what happens 10 years after they close up shop, if they have been able to demonstrate that the plume is no longer migrating, that there isn't any dangers to the subsurface, that there's no longer the opportunity for leak or anything to the waters, then the commission may grant a site closure certificate, but there isn't anything requiring it at that 10-year mark. The 10-year mark is just the soonest that they could apply in the post-injection period to transfer title.
Follow-up?
So the theory would be when they've injected all they can inject, then they – before they could say, we're all done, we go home, they have to actually apply to show the commission convincingly that, in fact, it isn't going to leak out somewhere else, that it's actually fully contained in the structure and it's going to stay there.
It's Senator Klayman, through the chair, yes, that's correct.
And last follow-up.
Absolutely.
So I guess at that point, after they've closed up and gotten permission to go home, if it turned out there was a mistake, then basically it's on the state of Alaska to deal with that at that point.
Senator Klayman, again, through the chair, yes, in a matter of speaking, I guess in some ways you might always imagine the state as landowner is we're essentially the last one there at the end of the day, generally speaking. So our hope is that through all of the regulatory, the rigorous statutory requirements, the inspections, the monitoring, and the post-closure trust fund that we would have allocated and planned for such a way to avoid any of those contingencies.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski, did you have a question?
Oh, just clarification. In some parts of the bill, you say carbon storage. In other parts, you say carbon dioxide. Are they to be used interchangeably?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, that is. There has been some interchangeable terminology. For the committee's awareness, the House version of the bill included some technical amendments to correct that and provide consistent terminology. That's true. There's some interchangeable different term usage.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I realize this is more a question for the Finance Committee, but I'm not on the Finance Committee, so I'd like to ask a question now if I can.
Sure.
You're probably not going to be able to answer this. You're going to say you have to talk to the Department of Revenue. Can you explain the Department of Revenue's zero fiscal note? I mean, it seems to me like this would implicate we hope to raise revenue. It seems like this is not a simple task that you are setting them out to accomplish. So I suppose we need to have them here, but can you attempt to answer that question?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I apologize. You mean the zero fiscal note in terms of revenues or expenses?
Perhaps I'm reading it wrong. I thought it was expenses.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, in the context of expenses, we don't believe at this time that there's additional expenses occurred, and frankly, we at the Department of Revenue that they're able to kind of manage this revenue program with that existing staffing capacity, and so it's quite possible that down the line, years ahead, if there's significant projects underway and there's significant disputes about the cost, the appropriate revenue assessments, there may be forthcoming requests, but at this time we think we're able to move forward with the program without those expenses.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just, and I'm not sure if it deals specifically with this, but I had a question about enhanced oil recovery wells specifically. So a class two well versus what a class six well does, and how those are determined. And so I guess first with that.
Sure, yes. Senator Kawasaki through the chair. So at present, an enhanced oil recovery well is one that's going to be obviously dedicated to that purpose. And when you're using one for geologic storage, which would be a class six, you're talking about a very different concentration of CO2, the amount that's going to be going down in there, and also as well as the specific purposes of that. Now, where that transition from a class two to class six is, the EPA is currently working on some proposed rules to provide more clarity around what those specific transition thresholds would be. But at this point, it's just the statement that when the safety and protections or that are designed in the well are no longer applicable for class two, you need to transition to class six.
And
follow up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The section relating to specifically for enhanced oil recovery, then I guess it's still sort of, it says the commission will adopt those regulations. So we haven't even heard what the federal government's going to do on class six wells. And I guess at some later time, the AOGCC will have to take that up too.
Senator Kawasaki, I do believe that's correct through the chair.
Thank you.
All right, Deputy Director, you have one more slide left. I'll let you proceed with that.
Thank you. Yes, so we are on slide 30 here. And again, in this section, we're just doing through sections 32 and 35. These are conforming amendments. So as was brought up before, that anywhere where oil and gas exploration licensing is excluded, we're similarly excluding it for carbon storage. Anywhere that it's permitted, we're also permitting here. And so you can see noted on the screen the various different areas in which we are doing so, again, consistent with oil and gas.
No questions.
And then Section 36 adds a new subsection for DNR to administer the storage facilities after that closure certificate has been issued. And it's the duty of the state to manage the DNR would be entitled to do that.
No questions?
Great. And then lastly, sections 37 through 39 are just the general provisions to adopt regulations and titles and effective dates of legislation.
Very good. Any additional questions? Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner, Deputy Director. For going through that sectional. I know that we had invited testimony from Kevin Connors from the Regulatory Compliance and Energy Policy with the Energy and Environmental Research Center. However, we are at 5:00. So we will adjourn at this time. I believe that your department had suggested him as a speaker, and so perhaps we can collaborate on when we could hear from him, perhaps on Wednesday, I don't know. So that concludes our meeting for today. The next meeting will be Wednesday, March 15th at 3:30 p.m. At that time on the agenda is Senate Bill 68, Public Notice for Water Rights, Senate Bill 34, Citizens Advisory Committee on Federal Areas, and Senate Bill 87, Lumber Grading Program. So at this time, we will adjourn. The time is 5 p.m.